This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The accepted wisdom in American politics is that the moderate center prevents either party from moving too far to the extreme. In the new book, Off Center, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson write that the Republican Party has managed to defy this accepted wisdom. They say the party has strayed from the moderate middle of public opinion, sided with extremes, and yet faced little public backlash. After making this case, Off-Center analyzes the techniques Republicans have used to move the political agenda further to the right. Jacob Hacker is an associate professor of political science at Yale and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's written for The New Republic, The Nation, and The New York Times and LA Times. Paul Pearson is a professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley and a former professor of government at Harvard. You write that Republicans have defied the normal laws of political gravity. Which laws do you have in mind?
Well, there are two laws that we have in mind. You know, the conventional wisdom is that politicians almost always seek the center. That's because they need to capture swing voters, people right in the middle of the electorate, to gain office. So politicians are expected to generally try to appeal to sort of the moderate center of public opinion. The second law that we talk about is that we have a very convoluted political system with lots of checks and balances. It was designed to make action very difficult. So if you are trying to change politics and policy, you shouldn't be able to radically change them, with at least not without really strong public support for your actions. But what Republicans have done essentially is govern quite far to the right of the center of public opinion and at the same time achieve and pursue many of their most conservative goals. So to us, that's very puzzling. It really is defying what we think of as the normal course of American politics.
You argue in your book that Republicans have been able to win elections in spite of being further to the right than the majority of Americans, than the mainstream of America. What evidence do you have that the Republican Party is further to the right in its agenda than the majority of Americans or the majority of Republicans who voted for them?
Well, in the book, we run through a great deal of evidence that looks at Republican politicians and also the activist members of their party, what's sometimes referred to as the base, which show that on a whole set of issues having to do with both the voting behavior of politicians and the positions that are staked out by activists, that they've moved way to the right over the last 20 or 25 years. The changes are really quite dramatic and can be demonstrated systematically. So one might think, based in part on what Jacob was just saying about how politicians try to stay close to where the voters are, that must mean that voters have moved well to the right as well. But in fact, if you look systematically at public polling evidence, and there are political scientists who measure every public opinion poll and look at the same questions that have been asked repeatedly over many, many years, there's simply no sign that, in fact, the opinions of voters have shifted to the right at all on the major issues.
So one of the questions you pose in the book is, if the Republican Party is further to the right than mainstream America, how have they managed to win elections? And what answers do you give to that?
Well, I think you really have to focus on both sides of the story in terms of elections. Well, one side is the electoral battlefield or the geographic map. And as we point out in the book, Republicans just have a big edge on the electoral battlefield right out of the starting blocks. For example, in the Senate, over the last three Senate elections, Democrats have actually picked up 2.5 million more votes in the last three elections in total than Republicans, but right now they're holding 44 seats in the Senate to Republicans 55. So there's a really dramatic bias on the Senate side in favor of generally Republican-leaning smaller states. On the House side, we've heard a lot about redistricting and gerrymandering, and that's certainly part of the story. In fact, in the most recent election, 2004, Bush won about 52% of the vote, but he won in about 59% of the nation's congressional districts. So that suggests Republicans do have an edge there. But I think it's also important to note that in the House side, that money is really important, and the Republicans just have a huge edge in terms of their both the amount of money they have and their ability to distribute it to Republican incumbents. So the electoral battlefield is really important. It's very tilted in favor of Republicans. The other thing we talk about in the book is that not only is the battlefield tilted, but Republicans have gotten very good at figuring out how to fight the battle on the terms that are most beneficial to them. That is, they use their very strong control of government and of the political agenda to shift the terrain of conflict onto those issues that most help them, such as national security issues and the war on terrorism. And you might say, well, you know, that's just part of politics. But as we point out in the book, the Republicans are just much more coordinated than previous parties have been, and they've used government essentially to shut out the opposition party from any meaningful participation in public debate. So until recently, it really was the game of politics was really like journalist Ron Brownstein described as a game of a baseball in which only one team was at bat.
Another point you make about elections is that in districts or in states where the Republican is pretty much a shoo-in to win, that the primaries become more important. In what sense do the primaries become more important in the situation, and how do you think Republicans have taken advantage of that?
This is a crucial change in American politics, that so many politicians are sitting in safe seats. There's less turnover in the House these days among sitting members than there was in the Soviet Politburo in the old days of the Soviet Union. 97-98% of incumbents are typically reelected. So if you're sitting in a safe seat like that, which most sitting politicians are, and you're worried about keeping your job, the only place where you're likely to face a threat is in the primary, where you could potentially be unseated by some kind of a challenger. And, of course, primary electorates are very small. Most people don't vote in primaries, and they're limited to the most energized, most enthusiastic members of the political party that the sitting incumbent is part of. And that means that those most intense elements of the base, which tend also to be the most politically extreme, really become important gatekeepers for politicians who are trying to develop their careers and stay in power. And that's one of the reasons. We don't think it's the only reason, but it's a very important reason why the Republican Party has moved so far to the right. It's partly that they have just moved that way ideologically, but it's also that they do face this incentive of really wanting to appeal to their base so they don't have to worry about being challenged in a primary.
Are there ways that you think that Republicans are trying to control primaries in a way any different from the way Democrats are?
Well, I think that both sides of the political spectrum, both Democrats and Republicans, have witnessed these same trends towards increasing numbers of safe seats. But in the Republican Party, this transformation has resulted in a much greater pull toward the extremes. You know, one piece of evidence for this is a University of Texas political scientist looked at the changes in the Republican and Democratic parties that had caused partisan polarization. And they went and they looked at every race over the last 20 years or so. And one of the striking things was that when Republicans were replaced by other Republicans, that is, a Republican incumbent lost office or left office, and then another Republican replaced him, that Republican was always much more conservative than the one before him. The same wasn't true on the Democratic side of the aisle. That is, when Democrats replaced other Democrats, there was not a big shift to the left. So this is clearly something that is a much stronger pull to the extremes on the Republican side that's caused by primaries. And in the book, we talk about one possible cause of this, which is that Republican activists are much more cohesive and conservative than Democratic activists are cohesive and liberal. For example, Republican activists have moved dramatically to the right over the last 30 years, according to the well-respected opinion survey, the National Election Studies. They've moved so far to the right, in fact, that they are farther away from independent voters than they were in the mid-1960s when Barry Goldwater was nominated as the Republican standard bearer. And the other thing we know about Republicans is they're very well organized at the grassroots level. They're organized through churches and through local organizations and school boards, and that kind of organization translates into getting out very intense, motivated, ideological voters in primaries.
So one of your points about primaries Republican primaries now is that you think that Republicans who are further to the right in the primary in a safe seat, in a seat that's likely to go Republican or in any election that's likely to go Republican, that it's the candidate more further to the right that's likely to get the backing of the party and the money from the party and the money from certain powerful right-wing groups.
Yes, those groups become a key gatekeeper for the for people who want to be successful in the party, and we can see that in the conservatism that's evident among members of the House and Senate on the Republican side, and especially among their leaders who are also tightly connected to these key groups in the base. But of course, the other crucial part of the story here is that politicians wouldn't be able to move so far to the right if they didn't feel like they were going to have some protection around election time. And some of that, of course, has to do with the geographic electoral advantages and the financial advantages that we were talking about before. But it also has to do with very sophisticated techniques that they've developed to allow politicians to appear more moderate to a mainstream general election audience than, in fact, those politicians actually are with respect to the policies that they're carrying out.
Give us an example of what you mean.
Well, we can see good examples in the news today where there are these big fights going on about the budget. Right now, Congress is struggling to pass a budget, and there's a lot of discussion about how Republicans are actually less unified, that there's more opposition than there has been in the recent past. But a lot of that opposition is really theatrical rather than substantive. There are efforts being made to allow moderate, potentially vulnerable Republicans who are facing re-election next year to, as the lingo sometimes goes, create a little daylight between them and the Republican leadership. So they'll cast a vote in opposition to the leadership, but only in circumstances where it's going to make a very marginal change in the political agenda, or where they know that they're going to end up being on the losing side, or where they know that any kind of changes that are introduced at one stage in the legislative process can be taken out at a later stage of the legislative process. So we talk at length in the book about the various ways in which moderation can be created, or at least an appearance of moderation can be created, without jeopardizing a more radical agenda that the GOP continues to pursue.
So you're basically saying that some people who consider themselves Republican moderates and vote against vote with the Democrat and against the Republican agenda are basically given permission to do so when Republicans know that the bill's going to pass anyways.
This certainly happens. We have lots of evidence that this has happened on high-profile legislative drives in the House, and it helps account for the fact that we've had so many bills passed with one or two extra votes. What happens is that the Republican leadership counts up the votes, figures out that it has a few to spare, and then carefully doles them out to Republican moderates so that they can declare their independence from the party to their constituents. So the point is that the Democrats have found it very difficult to get moderates to come on board when it really matters, when it's going to mean a key defeat for the Republicans. And we've seen that again and again. Perhaps the most revealing statistic on this isn't what's happened in Congress. It's the fact that George W. Bush has yet to veto a single bill since he's been in office. And you have to go back to our sixth president, John Quincy Adams, to find someone who has a record of lasting an entire presidential term without vetoing a bill.
I'm not sure whether you're challenging the sincerity of certain Republican moderates or whether you're saying that certain Republican moderates can't afford to vote against party initiatives because they will lose their seat, and so they're too intimidated sometimes to vote their conscience, and therefore they will only vote their conscience when given the green light by their own party.
Well, I think it's hard to get in the heads of individual politicians, and you would probably find that for different politicians there are different stories that would come closest to the truth, but I think there are elements of both these things going on. In some cases, you have politicians acting this way out of fear. They go along with the leadership because they're afraid of what the consequences will be. And it, you know, one consequence, as you said, Terry, could be a primary challenge, but another consequence could be losing access to those who, in a much more centralized congressional apparatus, are the ones who are doling out benefits to various members. So there are a lot of potential costs to crossing the leadership in a meaningful way. But we do think that some of this stuff is so clearly staged when you look at it closely.
Give me an example of something that you thought was staged.
A dramatic example would be the struggles in the Senate back in 2003 over major tax cuts that were being proposed. One of the signature items on the Republican agenda has been very, very substantial tax cuts. And as we document in the book, these tax cuts would not have been easy to pass if there hadn't been substantial efforts to suggest that they were going to be much more equally distributed and much less expensive than, of course, turned out to be the case. In 2001, there was a surplus in the budget, so it was relatively easy to convince people that tax cuts were a reasonable idea. But by 2003, you had the beginnings of the run-up to the war, and you also had large budget deficits. So there was a lot of concern about the scale of the tax cuts. And several ostensible moderates in the Senate announced very publicly that they would not vote for the tax cuts that the Bush administration was proposing unless they were reduced dramatically in size. Originally, the Bush administration was asking for about $600 billion in tax cuts over 10 years, and they said they wouldn't vote for more than $350 billion in tax cuts. So the Republican leadership in Congress dealt with this problem not by actually reducing the scale of the tax cuts, but by using essentially budgetary tricks of phasing in the tax cuts gradually and announcing that they would miraculously sunset 10 years later on. And by doing that, they were able to introduce a new budget bill, which, if it stays in effect, would cost $1 trillion over 10 years. Having made their public statement about how they were going to stand up and not accept a budget-busting $600 billion bill, those Senate moderates then signed on to a bill that, if it stays in effect, would cost $1 trillion.
How do you think the Republican approach to what you describe as controlling the vote of Republican moderates compares to how Democrats try to control votes so that they have a chance of winning on certain bills or, you know, defeating other bills?
Well, there's no question that Democrats used some of these techniques when they were in the majority. I was in a conversation with Norm Ornstein, who's at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, and who has been a longtime observer of Congress, very well-respected observer of Congress, who made this point the other day that, of course, these things are not a Republican invention, but as he put it, they've ratcheted things up to an entirely different level. If you look again at facts, at the scores that are given for how much unity a party maintains, and again, this very striking point that Jacob mentioned, that after now 5 years in office, George Bush has yet to veto a single bill. That's a sharp contrast with previous presidents who, by this point in office, would usually have vetoed a couple of dozen bills. That's a very strong example of how Republicans have really maintained a united front in a way that's without precedent in American politics.
Do you think the Republican leadership has innovated new techniques for controlling the political agenda?
We do. I mean, again, a lot of these things are not unprecedented. In a lot of cases, what you're talking about is refinements. And also, I think this is an important part of the puzzle, too. The fact is simply their goals are more extreme. I think they're further from the center than has been true for previous leaderships. So there are refinements, but there are some things that are quite new. One, in addition to some of the things that Jacob was talking about, it is the way that the laws themselves are designed so that they appear more moderate than they are. Maybe the most important but also revealing example is the 2001 tax cut legislation, which was designed in ways, as I said earlier, both to make it look less expensive than it was and to make it look like it was distributed in ways that would be more acceptable to average voters. One aspect of that design I think is particularly revealing, which is that people on average incomes what they got from the tax cut bill of 2001, they got right away in a way that was made very visible for them. People received a check with a nice little letter from Congress and the White House within a matter of weeks after the bill was passed in 2001. The very substantial benefits for the most affluent Americans were phased in much more gradually so that they would receive less attention. And there's a striking example, again, that's unfolding right now, though without receiving any press attention at all. Beginning in January 2006, so in 2 months, there's going to be a new round of cuts that were passed in 2001 but are just going into effect in January of 2006. And 97% of the benefits from these tax cuts will go to people making over $200,000 a year. So that's an example of legislative design where the bill is very carefully structured in ways that its more moderate or appealing elements to average voters are presented right up front, and its less appealing elements are hidden.
Another thing that you cite in terms of how you think the Republicans have managed to keep a tight control of the political agenda is changing the way that conference committees operate. What do you have to say about that?
Conference committees are where the House and the Senate have to come together to work out their differences if they passed slightly different versions of legislation and then come back with a bill that can be agreed on by both the House and the Senate. And traditionally, this used to be an area where essentially you were just doing that, working out differences between the two versions. But what Republicans have done is to use conference committees as a whole new, tightly controlled environment in which they can rewrite legislation to pursue more extreme goals. So it is now typical in these conference committees for the leadership essentially to handpick who is going to participate and to hold their meetings in private without any participation from Democrats, except occasionally one of these Democrats that Jacob was mentioning who lives in a state that Bush carried and who has agreed to negotiate on their terms. All other Democrats are excluded from these negotiations. The bills are then rewritten in ways that are typically much more conservative in many cases than the bills that came out of at least one of the two chambers. And they're brought and often include significant elements that were not part of the original legislation, or at least not in anything like the form that they turn up out of the conference committee. These bills are then brought back to the floor of the House and the Senate, where they cannot be amended. They're simply presented for an up or down vote. And that's a really powerful form of agenda control, because in many cases you'll get a bill that has a popular label on it, like tax cut. Or a bill for a prescription drug benefit, that politicians are very reluctant to vote against, even if they know that the details of the legislation have been rewritten in ways that are quite objectionable.
Would you give us an example of a bill that you think was rewritten in conference committee in the way that you've just described?
Well, the classic example, I think, is the prescription drug bill, which started out in some ways as a kind of old American politics style agreement, where you had a pretty conservative bill that came out of the House and then a more moderate bill that came out of the Senate, where you needed significant Democratic support in order to get it through without a filibuster. And Ted Kennedy played a very prominent role in helping to fashion a compromise that wasn't anything like ideal from his perspective, but he thought acceptable, a compromise bill that came out of the Senate. The bill then went into a conference. Democrats, again, except for the most conservative Democrats, were completely excluded from the conference. No House Democrats were allowed to participate in the conference meetings. And the bill was rewritten and pushed on a number of important dimensions, way to the right. And then when it came back to a vote, and again, when it comes up for a vote, you're not allowed to make any kind of amendments. Kennedy was livid. And said this is not at all what we had agreed to before. But a lot of senators who were then put in a position where they were going to have to vote no on a prescription drug bill, didn't want to do that, didn't want to be seen as casting a vote in that way. And so the bill ends up passing, even though it's radically different from the bill that had originally passed the Senate.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. They're the authors of the new book, Off Center. You write about the architects of what you call the new power structure of the Republican Party, and you say these are people who sit at the intersection of money, mobilization, and authority. And examples of people in this position you give are Karl Rove, Tom DeLay, Grover Norquist. I mean, doesn't it go without saying that people who are politically power sit at the intersection of money, mobilization, and authority? Is there anything different here?
Yes, I think there is. You know, and there's two things that have really changed, and we call these people DeLay, Rove, Norquist, and others who are at this crucial juncture. We call them power brokers. And what's changed is that the old power brokers in many ways were often fairly pragmatic deal makers. These new power brokers, as we call them in the book, are very ideological. I mean, the one thing that really connects all three of the people we just mentioned, Rove, DeLay, and Norquist, is that they are very hardcore conservatives, with the possible exception of Rove, who's a bit more pragmatic, but nonetheless, who's made his name by getting President Bush to appeal to his conservative base. The second difference, and I think this is the more important difference in many ways, is that these power brokers are working with a much stronger set of resources. They're at the intersection and brokering in a much more powerful way than political leaders of similar sort were in the past. They have huge amounts of resources at their disposal. And they're able to link together those resources through interest groups and through high-profile donors up to politicians in a way that they really control. They're really the gatekeepers into entry into the halls of influence. And we really haven't seen that to the same extent, at least not in the recent past. Each of these people like Norquist and Rove really gets to decide who gets access to whom. And there's a really revealing story that actually when people wanted to meet with the leadership and with the president, they would talk with Grover Norquist, who's the head of Americans for Tax Reform, who has no formal authority in the matter. Norquist would then talk with Rove, and the two of them would decide who got access to the inner sanctums of power. And we see that all of the people who were in these positions, their staff members, have all worked for each other at various points in time. So there's a real social structure here that goes beyond the formal authority that these power brokers have. And I think that represents a really dramatic shift in the structure of power since the 1960s and 70s.
When talking about the people who you describe as power brokers, people who you just mentioned, Tom DeLay, Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, the question comes up, what tense should we speak of them in as power brokers? You know, Tom DeLay has been indicted. He's no longer a majority leader. Karl Rove, it appears he's being investigated by the special prosecutor. Grover Norquist is implicated in the corrupt lobbying of Jack Abramoff. So do you think that some of the people who you describe as power brokers are losing or have lost their power? And if so, how do you think the Republican Party may be on the verge of changing?
Well, there's no question that the Republicans are facing the biggest challenge to their majority status that they've faced, I think, since they originally took control of Congress in 1994. And the scandals, and as you point out, there are multiple scandals. It seems like a new one is breaking almost every day, or an old one is extending into new circles. The scandals are a quite important part of that challenge that they're facing. The question, though, really is, in the end, how much difference is it going to make? The core of our view would be that there is a system that connects these people. Grover Norquist said in an interview recently, you know, if I were to be run over by a bus, there would be somebody else who could take my place. If Karl Rove were run over by a bus, there would be somebody who would be able to take his place. And over the last 10 years or so, you've seen powerful figures in the Republican leadership take a fall before for one reason or another. It's easy for us at a particular moment to think of a particular individual like Tom DeLay or Karl Rove as being indispensable. But back in the mid-1990s, Newt Gingrich was seen as indispensable. Who remembers Newt Gingrich these days except as the person who started it all? But when he fell as Speaker, it had no particularly noticeable or enduring effect upon the Republican coalition. Trent Lott fell as a result of a scandal the same way. Our view would be that it's the system that these folks are part of that's the central part of the story, and that it's a mistake to focus too much on the individuals.
As the House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay was credited with figuring out, many ways for arm twisting, for keeping people in line. I mean, that is it fair to say that's considered one of the things that made him so strong in his position? What did he innovate in terms of arm twisting?
Well, I think that one thing that really should be recognized is that the leadership only twists arms when it has to. And what it hopes to do is make sure that most of its members are on board most of the time. And so one thing that's not much recognized about DeLay is that he was actually very good at looking out for Republican members if they were willing to stick with the party line. And that's a big shift in Congress. It used to be that the congressional committees really were the center of power, and that the majority party, was sort of a scheduler of the congressional agenda, but really had not, did a few other things. But that most of the power to make policy, to decide what issues got considered, lay with the congressional committees that had exclusive jurisdiction over certain areas. And what Newt Gingrich did and Tom DeLay continued was basically a complete and total subordination of the congressional committees and their leaders to the Republican Party leadership in the House. And as a result, and now congressional committee chairs have to actually audition to become head of their committees. And one of the key things that they have to show is that they can raise a lot of money for the Republican Party. So really what DeLay has done has turned around Congress so that he has both the keys, the carrots and the sticks. And he hopes to use the carrots, the money that he's been able to raise, the fact that he can pursue redistricting initiatives in Texas that'll mean that more Republicans will be in Congress after the next election. So he hopes he uses the carrots. But if he has to, he will use the sticks. And DeLay has been very tough when he has used sticks. We tell the story of Marj Rockema, who is a moderate Republican from New Jersey, and who essentially was shut out of a committee chair that she had been seeking her entire 20-year congressional career. DeLay apparently had funded indirectly her primary opponent and made clear to her that she would never really have any effective power in the House. When she had come into Congress almost 20 years ago, she had said, really it was quite poignant to think about today, that this had been the greatest dream of her life and that the one thing she wanted to do was to move up in the hierarchy of Congress and become a committee chair. But she left Congress 20 years later not having achieved that goal and basically having been told by Tom DeLay that if she wasn't a team player, she wasn't going to be part of the institution she loved.
Do you think the Republican leadership has done anything that's illegal or unconstitutional in the way they've tried to control the agenda? Or do you think that they've just made very kind of strong, creative, powerful use of the rules?
Well, we certainly don't have any special insight as to whether or not laws have been broken. There are people who are investigating that right now. But we do think that the more profound thing and the more central thing that has happened is that they have, by creating this new level of unity and coordination, they have changed the character of the system in ways that have really undercut our traditional sense of checks and balances, of cross-cutting pressures that enforce diversity and moderation in the kinds of views that are expressed in Washington. And whether or not laws were broken, that change in the system needs to be understood, and people need to think about how to respond to it. Our deepest concern in writing the book was a sense that accountability and responsiveness to the concerns of ordinary Americans has really been undermined in the last 15 years.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks
for having us on.
Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson are the authors of Off Center. Hacker is an associate professor of political science at Yale. Pearson is a professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley. You can read an excerpt of their book on our website, freshair.npr.org.